Welcome to the Friday night lecture here at Southboro LaBrie. Did you get a cookie yet? Wow, those are good, aren't they? If you didn't get one afterwards with the coffee. And yes, if you don't know me already, my name is Dave Friedrich. I'm one of the workers here at LaBrie. And yes, we're glad you're here. We pray for God to bring the people of His choice, and we're thankful that He brought you. And on that note, next week, our own Ben Kies will be continuing his lecture series on gratitude, the tug of war between gratitude and entitlement. So, yeah, that's last lecture of the term, I think. So make sure you come out. Well, for tonight, let's get right to the point. Is God a social construct? Or, put differently, is God merely a figment of our imagination? Or a projection of the mind? How do we respond to this kind of question? Or how do we respond to someone who says, yeah, of course? Or what do I do if I feel compelled to answer yes? Big questions. And this hour is going to take your concentration. It won't be a walk through the park. Consider how the following is a parable of projection. Okay? Imagine you are Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz. Or if you're a guy, you can be Theodore. Okay? Imagine there you are in Kansas, and then suddenly this whirlwind takes you, your dog, your house, all the way to Oz, to this uncivilized place where they still have wizards and witches. And yes, despite the talking animals and the magic and the bright colors, all you want to do is go back to gray Kansas. Well, because that's where your family is, that's where your home is, that's where you belong. But you hear, well, the only way I can get back is through this wizard, this mysterious person who they say came from the clouds, who has incredible powers, never or rarely seen by his subjects. Well, you're determined to see him because you want to get home. So off you go, and on your way, of course, you meet a scarecrow, you meet the Tin Man, you meet the lion, and they join you on your journey, and you're all hoping that this powerful Oz will give you each what you desire. And after a long time, you get there, and he says, well, actually, before I can give you anything, you gotta kill the Wicked Witch, and you're not really into killing people, but after some adventures and accidentally killing you, you come back a second time, and there, this time, his true identity is exposed. And so Toto, yeah, totally, or accidentally tips over the screen, and there for all to see is this little man. This guy who used to work in the circus, a ventriloquist from Omaha, Nebraska. And he's trying really hard to convince everybody that there is a wizard, when in fact there is none. It's all an illusion. And so you blurt out and you say, I think you are a very bad man. And he responds, oh, I'm really a very good man, but a very bad wizard, I must admit. And he admits he has nothing to give you or your friends. In fact, everything you've needed, you've had within yourself. So you're like, yeah, okay, the scarecrow figured out how to get the brain power, the lion got some courage, the Tin Man got some heart, all without the help of the wizard. And you've been wearing shoes the whole time that could have got you home at any minute, any moment. And yet, if you read the book, after this, the scarecrow and the Tin Man and the lion insist that the wizard still give them the brain, the heart, and courage. And so reluctantly, he gives the scarecrow a brain full of bran, a bran, new brain, and the Tin Man a silk heart full of sawdust, and the lion a potion of courage. And so, their unshakable faith in the wizard gives these otherwise useless items this superstitious satisfaction. And here's how it ends. Oz, left to himself, smiled to think of his success in giving the Scarecrow and the Tin Woodman and the Lion exactly what they thought they wanted. "How can I help being a humbug, a fraud?" he said, "when all these people make me do things that everybody knows can't be done." So to imagine this is to imagine how many people think and feel about God. That behind the curtain, there's just con men and illusions. So, for some, this is good news. For others, this is bad. Yeah, how do we respond to this? Big question. I've titled this lecture, "Is God a Social Construct?" It could be asked differently. Is God just a crutch, a coping mechanism? Wim Reitkerk, the retired director of Dutch Labrie, has given a lecture numerous times called "Is God a Projection?" And a similar one, "Is God an Ideology?" And they're printed actually in this book, along with other lectures. He's also given the lecture many times, and this is one of the most important Labrie lectures I've read and listened to. I listened to it about 20 years ago, and if anything, it's more relevant today than when Wim started lecturing on it, I think over 30 years ago, if that's right. Dick, you would probably know. Yeah, I encourage you to read or listen to the lectures if you get a chance, but I'm going to basically briefly mention thinkers that he devotes a lot more time to in his lectures, Feuerbach, Marx, and Freud. And then I'm going to try and build off of his lecture and take it further down some different roads and mention some different people than he does. People like the contemporary author Yuval Noah Harari. Just wondering, who's read him? I know Dick has. Okay. Or heard of him? Okay. Well, tonight you will. He's really expressing one of the most recent versions of this question. And this question, it can be asked in different ways depending on the discipline it's being asked in. So whether it's history or philosophy or psychology, the social sciences, genetics, neuroscience, each has their own way of asking the question, although it's rarely a question. It's usually a declared fact, something everybody knows, of course. But yet, despite the different ways it can be expressed, the root and implication and response can be similar, quite similar. So I hope to offer you tonight a way to be able to recognize it when you hear it in different disciplines or different contexts. So you can hear that common root and implication, and then I'm going to offer a response that's far from my own. It comes from what I have read and heard with my own tweaks here and there. And I hope it may help you. First, the saga. When was this question / declaration born? When did it come into history, really? How did it develop into a teenager, and how is it behaving as a full-grown adult here in 2018? So that's going to be the first half. Second half will be the response. And you need to know the story to respond well, I think. So first, the tale. One of the teachings Labrie takes very seriously is that we were made in the image of our Maker. So that even in our brokenness, each of us represents and reflects our Creator in our humanity, in the fullness of our humanity. And yeah, Anna had a reading this morning, and that explained that in a powerful way at the end from Madeleine Lengel. Well, over the last 200 years, certain influential thinkers have claimed the exact opposite. That's what's going on here, that we have made our Maker in our image, if that makes sense. So God merely reflects and represents our imagination. And so in other words, God doesn't exist. He's merely a fiction, a figment of our imagination, a projection, an illusion, a social construct, a genetic hang-up from the past, something that helped us survive sometime in the past. These kinds of things. The birth of this idea came during the 1800s, at a time when philosophers were becoming aware of just how much humans are interpreters of reality, so that we don't just receive information passively from the world, from each other. We actively interpret. This is Immanuel Kant, if you're into philosophy. He really put this on the map. Well, the German philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach, you're going to hear that name a few times tonight, born in 1804, died in 1872. He took this new insight, and he took it way down the road and applied it in a radical way to God. That's what he did. So that he's the first one that I know of that explicitly declared God is nothing but a projection. Or that he's nothing but our creative interpretation, not received from reality, but put onto reality. So in 1841, he wrote a book called The Essence of Christianity, where he tells us anthropology, the study of humanity, of human beings, anthropology is the essence of Christianity. And so in other words, when we think we're talking about God, in fact, we're merely talking about ourselves. And so whatever we lack or think we lack in ourselves, that's what we're projecting onto ultimate reality and call this God. So just like a projector projecting a movie onto a blank screen, kind of, we project Christianity or religion onto it. And the only reality God has is in our wish for him to exist. This wish fulfillment. And the greater the need, the greater projection. And so listen to this sweeping, dismissive, one-sentence summary. Only the poor man has a rich God. Whew. Punch in the gut from Feuerbach. So he saw this exposure as good news. We're no longer dependent on an illusion for salvation. We can get down to business and start depending on ourselves. All the resources we need are within ourselves. You hearing the wizard here? the Wizard of Oz, who tries, to tell the Tin Man, the Straw Man, and the Lion. They didn't need some ominous magical wizard anymore. A god to save them. All they needed was right there. Now, Feuerbach prophesied that this unmasking of religion and Christianity would soon do away with it. And while that is far from being the case, his ideas have had a lasting influence all the way up to the present, even in children's stories. And he probably didn't foresee how postmodernists would take what he's doing with God and apply it to everything, not just God. But that's getting ahead. One of his biggest disciples was Karl Marx, who took his ideas and applied them into the area of politics and economics. Karl Marx living from 1818 to 1883. This is when it's developing into a teenager. And like Feuerbach, Marx was, there is no objective reality to religion. Religious beliefs were merely the products of struggles in the classes of society when there's injustice going on. So religion was a means for capitalist property owners to keep the remaining masses of the poor in check in their place with the promise, hey, if you just stay there, don't worry. In the next age, you'll get what's coming to you. So don't make too much fuss. And on the other end, it was a tranquilizing drug for these poor, the opium of the people, the opiate of the masses, as we've heard it called, for those suffering injustice and unable to do anything about it. They were forced, in a sense, to invent or submit to this idea. Well, at least God will fix things in the next age. So where Feuerbach said the poor man had a rich God, Marx might say the suffering poor have a tranquilizing God. And Marx wasn't as belittling as Freud, because he was like, well, this is a sign of suffering that we need to address. Where Freud was a little more belittling. Or mean Feuerbach. Freud's coming. But he thought that a proletariat revolution that secured a classless society would do away with the religion, because the conditions that made it necessary are not there anymore. So you don't need any more religious opium when everybody's equal. Well, while religion in general, Christianity in particular, have outlasted these Marxist prophecies, Marxist ideas have had a lasting influence, especially in academia, especially in the social sciences. Another disciple of Freud, and what you see just through history is someone taking Feuerbach's ideas and then applying them to a new discipline, and eventually then to everything. But Feuerbach took this and applied it, of course, to psychology and psychoanalysis. So he agreed, yes, Christianity is an illusion, but for Freud, the cause wasn't being poor or a class struggle, but childhood neurosis. And he spells this out in The Future of an Illusion, written in 1927. And this is what he wrote. These religious ideas, which profess to be dogmas, are not the residue of experience or the final result of reflection. They are illusions, fulfillments of the oldest, strongest, and most insistent wishes of mankind. The secret of their strength is the strength of these wishes. So not the poor man has a rich God, or the suffering class has a tranquilizing God, but the childish individual has an exalted divine father. So he believed that these unresolved childhood conflicts compelled us to invent a comforting, exalted divine father. And this is supposedly how the gods were born. The conflicted child has a comforting God. Another punch in the gut. To mature, to come of age, to grow up, to become a responsible adult, both individually and in society as a whole, is to have the courage to admit there is no wizard. There's no exalted father in the heavens, right? It's bleak, but hey, that's just how it is. And like Dorothy and her friends, they're told, all that you have, all that you need, is within yourself. And for Freud, the biggest resource is science. And so while many have questioned Freud's unshakable faith in science, and some have wondered what wish fulfillments did Freud have that caused his beliefs or lack of beliefs, there's much to question his description of leaving childish, comforting, superstitious beliefs behind and courageously becoming an adult, atheist, scientific person of modernity. That's become a common script for many people in their journey to atheism. And we need to ask why many times. This is typically the gospel of atheism as it's put forward, the good news. And it's a narrative many people find purpose in and significance in. It's hard to do away with narratives. People are looking for them, and this is the narrative of atheism. And it can even feel for people daring and heroic to face the darkness all alone. And for others, of course, it brings utter despair. Well, the three people I've mentioned, these are men of modernism, which meant they had this incredible optimism, not only in unmasking religion and Christianity, but in what human reason, science, or Marxist revolt could accomplish. Many postmodernists call this confidence into question. That's the postmodern response. They've helped give us the postmodern skepticism and pessimism and sometimes just outright despair at all this. So they took Feuerbach's claim all the way down the road. Not only God, but maybe everything is projection. Then what do we do? And we thought we liberated ourselves from the gods, but now we need to be liberated from ourselves. Now what do we do? Kind of thing. Now, despite this response, modern optimism continues. It's not like postmodernism just wipes out modernism. Modernism keeps on trucking right beside pessimistic postmodernism. And the reductionistic views that we've heard about have not gone away. They're either restated in the classical language of Feuerbach or Freud, or they're restated in new contexts, new language. So now we're moving into how it's behaving as an adult. So we've looked at philosophy, politics, psychology. Now we're moving into the social sciences. In 1966, Peter Berger and Thomas Luckman wrote The Social Construction of Reality, a real groundbreaking book. And they stressed how our knowledge is constructed socially. So while in the past people were looking more at individually how people construct reality, they were looking more at how we do it as a group, as we interact with each other, and how we come to what everybody knows. And there's a weak version of this, and there's a strong version of this. The weak version can still leave room for an objective reality out there that we can have a correspondence to some degree of our constructs and how things really are. And that reality can break in, and people can break into our constructs and reorder them and help them become more faithful to the way things are. But there's a strong version of social constructionism that leaves little to no room for objective reality. And a little to no room for a correspondence between what I'm imagining things to be and what's really there. And so it's all projection and no revelation, either from the world or from people or from God. And the thing is with this is people can mix and match with this. So you can have people who are, hey, I'm going to have a kind of a weak version of this when it comes to the world and science maybe, and people, yeah, I can get to know the world and I can get to know people slowly over time, not perfectly, but at least better. And then there can be a switch when it comes to God. And then the strong version kicks in, and God is nothing but a social construct. And even if he could talk to us, hey, there's no way he could break through all these social constructs we have. So intentionally or unintentionally, religious truth claims get swept under the carpet. So that, yeah, religion, it's constructed merely to deal with things we haven't understood yet. And the more science explains things, the less religion is necessary. And so where Marx said the suffering community creates a comforting God, here the poor, confused community creates a convenient God of the gaps. And that God gets smaller and smaller. So you hear this sometimes in Christian circles. Well, this can't be explained by science yet, so that's why God is real. Well, then science keeps explaining things, and God gets a lot smaller over time. And so we've got to rethink, I think, what we're saying, how we're imagining God in the created order. But the guiding question in the social sciences, when it comes to religion at least, and Christianity, is typically not what might we learn about God. The guiding question is typically limited to what can we learn about human beings. So many times religion and Christianity just get reduced to, again, anthropology. So, you know, the question becomes, well, hey, what historical, cultural, social context caused this group of people to believe like this? That is an important question. It's a question a lot of Christians need to pay more attention to. But why limit ourselves to just that question? Why not also be open to the possibility that we have a creator who can communicate with us, despite our distortions of who he is or what he's like? The more recent versions of his goddess social construct come from Darwinian biology and neuroscience. So this is another way, yes, our question's behaving as an adult. And the thinking goes, if we believe in God, like anything, that belief must have helped us survive, must have been helpful for our survival in the past. And so how much of that is inherited through our genes or through human culture is still a debate. But we get books like The God Delusion by the new atheist biologist Richard Dawkins. Or you have this interesting book by the geneticist Dean Hammer, or Hammer, is that how you say his name? Not sure, but he wrote The God Gene, How Faith is Hardwired into Our Genes. So he proposed that there's a specific gene, VMAT2, that predisposes humans to spirituality or mystical experiences that must have been beneficial for our survival in the past. Why else would we have something? And so while this God gene, I'm not sure how much credibility it has in the scientific community as a whole, and he doesn't rule out the reality of God in this by any means, but his thinking illustrates, or his book illustrates, the new kind of thinking at work. Is that how did this belief, whatever it was, this religious belief, help us to survive, and how might it be carried through our genes, our genetic makeup? And then it can turn into, well, God is nothing but a genetic inheritance that helped us survive in the past. But of course, we don't need that anymore. We can grow up and move on. So now, while genetics used to be all the rage, now it's neuroscience. To say something authoritatively, you gotta throw in some neuroscience in there to make it sound credible. So joy, what's joy? Hey, joy is simply dopamine and serotonin in the brain. Next question, let's move on. That's what's going on. Not that we don't have things to learn there, but people are getting a little overexcited about it, I think. There's even something called neurotheology that attempts to explain religious experiences in neuroscientific terms. So, Paul, you know, he's going on the road to Damascus. He thinks he had an encounter with Christ. He probably just had a seizure. That's some of the thinking. Now, it doesn't have to be that dismissive. It's just sometimes that's a track people take. So that you can still have room, make room for real encounters with God, and then be trying to describe what's going on in the brain when that happens, if you could really do that. But there is a dismissive approach that can sound something like, well, you think you're having an experience of God, but really you're just experiencing chemicals in your brain. And that might have helped us survive in the past, but we don't need that anymore. Only primitive Homo sapiens need to believe and experience God to survive and do well. All right, we're almost near the end of the saga. This brings us to Harari, Yuval Noah Harari, and which is the book here I'm going to mention. He wrote this book, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. This is a New York Times bestseller, written in 2011. He is a professor of history at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And according to his TED Talk blurb, and the TED Talk has about 3 million hits, his book's been translated into 50 languages. Okay, so he's a historian who's something of an international rock star. I mean, you just look on videos of this guy, and there's tons of them. He's just talking to all kinds of people on all kinds of topics. And he's an interesting guy. He embodies so many different things. He embodies something of this scientific modern optimism, something of the pessimistic postmodernist take, as he filters everything through Darwinian biology and neuroscience, and with predictions of our transhumanist future, and throwing in a little Buddhism to boot. So he's not an easy guy to summarize and figure out. But his guiding question is, how did human beings rise from being these insignificant apes to these creatures that now dominate the planet? How did this happen? And the short answer he gives is our imagination. So this is something not totally new, but he gives it a new twist. According to Harari, only humans that we can tell have this ability to imagine, to have an imagination, which is for him the ability to create fictional stories. So when we all believe the same fictional story as humans, we can accomplish great things together that we never could have before, whether for good or for ill. So religious beliefs, they are merely one human fiction we have invented that have enabled us to come together in large numbers to accomplish great cultural feats and to dominate the planet. So if he was the wizard, he might have told Dorothy, okay, your little posse was believing a lie the whole time. You know, that's true. But look how it helped you come together and get everything you wanted. Isn't that great? Isn't that amazing? So conquering Homo sapiens need a unifying myth to do things together. And he doesn't just single out religion here. He goes and says money and corporations. He's got states and nations, legal systems and human rights. All of these are just human fictions. They come from the stories we tell. There's no reality to them. Human rights, he says, well, hey, this came from the Christian tradition where the Christians believe God gave humans certain value and dignity and status, being made in the image of God. But we know that's not true. So human rights as well are not true. And so he says, look, what do we do? Well, let's cut open the human body. And what do we see? You see a heart, you see lungs, you see DNA, but you don't see any human rights. You don't see a soul. So now we know that these are all inventions of the human imagination that come from the stories we tell. So he gives this illustration. He says, you know, take like a $20 bill and pretend you're going to give it to a monkey. And pretend the monkey can talk. And he says, tell him, this paper is worth all those bananas in your hand. And then say, let's do a trade. And the monkey's like, no way. Only humans believe those stories. And then he says, it's the most powerful story out there because everybody believes this one. All right. So for Harari, these stories, they're not worthless. They've enabled us to do incredible things, but just don't take them too seriously. Okay, the saga is over. Time for a response. Is anything unclear at this point? Confusing. Okay. There'll be a time for questions at the end, so if you've got questions, save them for then. So, depending on who you are, if you're a believer, your first response might be defensive. If you're normal. Understandably, you might want to fight back. You might want to punch Freud or Feuerbach in the gut. If you're honest. But what if, rather, we turned the other cheek and tried to learn something? Tried to listen? There's a practice here at Libri, and not only here at Libri, but with many Christians and many people who aren't Christians, to first listen and see if there's something we can learn from someone, even someone who's hostile to our faith, to something that is very central to who we are and what we believe. And I say practice because we don't always do that. We don't always do that well. But we do try to practice what the Epistle of James says. Be quick to listen and slow to speak. That was in the Monday book study with Joshua. Should be familiar with that. The late theologian Karl Barth from Switzerland considered the state of Christianity in Germany during the times of Feuerbach, so in the 1800s, and was under the impression that much of what Feuerbach witnessed in theology and in Christian practice was projection. The church was in a bad way. And many times, yeah, Christians are the biggest reason for both people believing and people not believing. That's a big fact. That he noticed, though, there was very little Christian substance in the church at this time, and a lot of misguided imagination going on. So Barth agreed with Feuerbach's critique of religion at this time to such a degree that in 1957 he wrote an introductory essay to The Essence of Christianity. And so he heard God's correction through Feuerbach of the church. Now, we might wish Barth was corrected in other areas by God and heard that, but we need that kind of listening, that humility to do that. That's not easy. What might God be saying to the church through its critics? Many times the critics sees where we're off better than we do. So we need to listen there. So maybe Dick needs to write an introductory essay to Harari's book. Can you add that to your writing schedule? Yeah. I remember hearing a lecture by a Christian philosopher and apologist who said sometimes he read Feuerbach as devotional material when he wanted to see how much he was putting on to God that didn't belong to God. Yeah. So yeah, our response should be, let's listen. Let's see if there's something I can learn from this person. How can they teach me something new, maybe, about the human condition? About living in God's world, even if they don't share my faith. How can they broaden my understanding in my life? This is what God wants for us, regardless of where it comes from. I love this phrase in Psalm 119, people have been reading in the morning prayer. It says in verse 32, you will broaden my heart. I love that phrase. God is into expanding our hearts, our lives. And Scripture does this. But any truth does this, wherever we find it. And all truth is God's truth anyway.
What psalm was that again?
That's Psalm 119, verse 32. But sometimes before we can expand, we need to be corrected. We need to get things out of the way. And that correction can come from surprising places. Here's another psalm. This is Psalm 50, verse 21. And this is God speaking to his covenant people in the Old Testament, the church at that time. And theft, adultery, deceit, slander are mentioned. And then God says, these things you have done, and I have been silent. You thought that I was one like yourself. But now I rebuke you and lay the charge before you. So projection, it didn't start with Feuerbach. He can't claim full credit for that. It started with the Scriptures. And many times it's associated with idolatry. So which is really just worshiping anything other than the God who made all things. And that can be a material thing. It can be a person. It can also be a concept, a wrong idea about God. And sometimes God's rebuke for this can come from places we're not ready for. We're not looking for. Sometimes people who just might be annoying to us. Irritating messengers we don't want to listen to. But maybe there's something to be heard. So how can we do this with Karl Marx, for example? Well, we can learn a lot of things from him, I think. One of the things is how people have used religion or Christianity to oppress or manipulate other people. And how might we be doing that in our churches? How might we be using Christianity to manipulate people? Or how do we use our future hope as an excuse not to go through the tough work of being changed or working towards changing our living and working environments for other people? Well, don't worry, that's coming in the next. You can just sit easy and relax. And we need to hear Karl Marx, I think. What can we learn from Freud? Well, it's certainly true. What happens in our childhood affects our relationship with God, how we think about him, how we don't, how we relate or don't relate to him. That is surely true. Maybe not exactly the way Freud imagined it. Paul Witz is somebody who's taken some of his basic insights and worked with them and tried to correct them where he thinks they went off. But this is an area he brought our attention to more than we were before. And so now any decent Christian counseling, at least, will at some point ask, who were your parents? What were they like? And what was your relationship like with them? And how has this played out in your relationship with God? Because we typically do the opposite of what Jesus said to do, which is we take the deficiencies of our earthly fathers and apply it to our heavenly Father and say, how much more? The exact opposite of what Jesus teaches us to do. And so a lot of Christian life is about letting Jesus correct our constructs. Learning from him, what did he mean by that word, Father? And how can we know the Father as he knows the Father? That's a lot of what the Christian life is about. Merrill Westfall wrote this book, Suspicion and Faith, The Religious Uses of Modern Atheism. It's a big book at Libris, Swiss Libris. For those who, there's a lot of people here at Swiss Libris tonight here. Well, what he does is, this is written in 1998. He's professor of philosophy at, or at least was at Fordham University in New York. And what he writes is that we should use the critiques of Feuerbach, Marx, Freud, even Nietzsche, for tools as of self-examination, what I've been talking about. So, in a sense, doing the Ignatian examine with these guys. He goes so far as to say these guys are like the Old Testament prophets in the Old Testament who expose projection, or rather idolatry, And all the corrupt practices that went with idolatry. So this was an exposing that happened first and foremost with the people of God. It wasn't like God went and out to the nations, was like, here, I'm going to say what's wrong with you. First and foremost, it was with his own people, the prophets. But I think that the power of these prophets are even more than these men I've mentioned, because, hey, if you project a false idea about God and God doesn't exist, it's not that big of a deal. But if you project a false idea onto your Maker, you deserve his wrath, as Paul says in Romans. You need forgiveness for that. You need redemption. You need to be redeemed. And thankfully, he's more than willing to do that. I wouldn't call these men prophets. They're more like the unbelieving nations, I think, around Israel in the Old Testament. So sometimes when Israel strayed from God and God's ways, he used the surrounding nations to judge them, to wake them up. It took that to do it sometimes. So I think if we're attentive, we too might hear God's correction through unbelievers. And this is a rebuke that can be found not just in modernist critiques, but in postmodern critiques too. And this is what Bruce Ellis Benson does in this book, Graven Ideologies. And so he goes to the postmodernists and does a similar thing with an inspiration from Westfall. And he looks at people like Nietzsche, but then others like Derrida, who continue to show how we make idols not just materially, but conceptually. How we have false ideas that we worship. And if you've done any theological training, you see this sometimes. You see people worshiping their theologies and their doctrines instead of the God of their theologies and doctrines. And that needs to be called out. Well, we also need to learn from the social sciences. So how our time and place in history really does influence how we see God. If you look at the paintings of Jesus through cultures and through the centuries, you notice Jesus ends up looking a lot like the people who are painting him. And that's not always wrong, but it's one of the factors, and sometimes that can help us see Jesus better, depending on what it is, and sometimes that can skew things. And so we need to think of our own time and culture. How does our culture help us see God better, and how does it block? How does it blind us? And as physical creatures, we need to know how our genes and the chemicals in our brain might affect our experience of God and how it does affect. How can we learn from this? How can we learn from these kinds of things? How can this, again, broaden our understanding? We need to be discerning, but we don't have to be afraid of any new discovery that's coming forth. And then there's Harari. Now, I don't share his atheistic orientation or his scientism. We'll talk about it in a minute, but he has all kinds of insights we need to pay attention to. How he highlights how we've been treating animals and each other and the planet. And what might be coming down the pipe in the future. There's some things there that we need to listen to. And I think most of the Christianity he presents is a Platonicized popular version of Christianity, a lot of which I would want to reject too. My guess, my hope, is that the Christians he must have rubbed shoulders with probably didn't have a lot of substance in their faith. That maybe they lost their saltiness, as Jesus said, and Harari and others want to throw it away, as Jesus said would happen. So again, how might God be rebuking the church through Harari? So yeah, we need to listen and learn. We need to learn how to listen, both for truth and distorted truth. So a partial truth presented as the total truth becomes a distorted truth. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot of in these men I've mentioned as well. From all that we can learn from them, I think a lot of this is going on. And so this is tricky. We're learning what to receive and what to resist from the same person. So how to chew the meat and spit out the bones kind of thing. And so, I don't think these critics have given some fatal blow to religious or Christian faith. So these ideas have been going on for a while, and they haven't shut down Christianity. But I hope if you haven't already, you'll be able to recognize and resist their reductionism. So yeah, reality is big and broad and deep. And we need to resist those who want to shrink it to one thing going on. And maybe you've heard that in these people. And especially you got to listen for those words like merely, just, nothing but. I hear those words and my alarm goes off. And I want to hear what's coming next. So yeah, we need to listen for those cues and then ask some questions. And so my question for these men would be, is your explanation really the total explanation of what's going on? Why does this have to be the only thing happening? So it's like when one insight becomes the only insight, we start to become dogmatic and narrow-minded and reductionistic. And that's one thing LaBrie has taught me, is listen for reductionism and resist it, wherever you find it. And so when we try to reduce life to one thing in life, and we need to train our ears to hear this. So scientism is a type of reductionism, which limits all knowledge to what can be measured, say, for example. Good science, which there's plenty of, knows its limits, is a blessing to the earth, and makes room for other fields of knowledge. Say, like poetry. Scientism knows not its limits. So imagine a huge circle that represents all of reality. Of course, you could never draw that big enough. And then within that, there's another little circle that represents what scientists have observed and are trying to tell us about. And scientism claims that the only thing that can count as true and real knowledge is within that circle. So if your poetry circle is outside that somewhere, sorry, that doesn't count. Unless you can bring it inside our circle somehow. And so it's the nothing buttery fallacy. Life is nothing but, and then you fill in the blank. Life is nothing but biology or genetics or neuroscience. And Christians have their own ways of doing this too, right? We can have a circle of sin sometimes. Your depression, your boredom, your anxiety, it's nothing but sin in your life, always and every time. Well, yeah, we can all get our own little circles going on. The critics, though, here of Christianity say, your religion is nothing but your poverty, your class struggle, your childhood, your historical context, your genes, the chemicals in your brain, the vibrating strings of quantum mechanics. Again, see here, we can reduce all of life or religion to one thing. And that's never a good thing. And it's typically the thing we just happen to be really into and get really excited about. And I do this too. I get into a new book and a new idea and suddenly that's everything. This is, you know, or it's like doing the Enneagram and suddenly you're just seeing the Enneagram and only the Enneagram everywhere where it's a helpful insight, but it's not the only insight. And this can easily just turn into another form of idolatry where we're these worshiping creatures. We just have to worship. And if we don't worship the God who created all things, our tendency is to worship some small thing in creation. Or two things, as Dick points out, idols come in pairs. So yeah, we just need to be reminded of this over and over again. Life's bigger than what I'm into at this point or what I'm studying. I don't want to give that up necessarily. That's an important part of life, but it's not the only thing. And we shouldn't express it that way to anybody. And we need to be aware of people who do express that. And I think there's no other way for me, there's no better way that I've found to keep myself from doing this than Jesus, who is the Lord of all of life. Not just one little part of life. All of life in its fullness. And yes, he takes us through a narrow gate, but it's always to a broad place. He's not into constricting us. That's not his goal. His goal is to expand life, to expand us. And according to the physicists, he's even expanding the universe. where reductionism is constricting. It's greedy. It wants to claim too much in this. All history is merely the history of class struggle. So all philosophies, all religion, it's just a product of this class struggle. Well, if that's true, what about Marx's ideas? How did he escape this situation and give us the bird's eye view of everything? How come he's there and the rest of us are left down here? So to dismiss all ideas is to dismiss your own ideas too. And so we need to learn to hear that and have that question. Or how about Freud when he said belief in this exalted divine father brings people comfort. Therefore, religion and Christianity are nothing but a comforting illusion. Do you hear that big jump he made there? Just because you wish for something and it's comforting doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So I have a big desire to eat another cookie around the corner. Just because I wish that doesn't mean those cookies aren't there. I hope they're still there. We'll see how many are left. Or in the opposite way, what if atheists like Freud have a desire for God not to wish? And what if that's comforting to them? Does that somehow prove God does exist? See that when psychology is used to prove or disprove Christianity, it's overextending its limits. It's claiming too much. And when we reduce what people say to why they say it, we're cheapening them, right? Because we could do that to Freud too, but we shouldn't do that to him or to anybody, and don't let anybody do that to you. All right, got another 5 minutes or so. And I think the same goes for Harari. And he insists, when it comes to Homo sapiens, only Darwinian biology is objectively true. So it's a form of scientism that we talked about. So all beliefs and values we hold are merely subjective creations of our imagination. They've helped us to evolve and dominate the world, but they're not true. Well, if this is true for all Homo sapiens, wouldn't that include Harari's imagination? I wonder. So his book doesn't simply report observations of biology in some detached way without imagination. He's using his imagination to reconstruct the story, the history behind all these facts. He's using a whole lot of imagination to reflect on the importance and the significance of these supposed facts. He's making value judgments. He's filling in some gaps with his imagination. So how come his imagination can produce the history, a brief history of humankind, but the rest of us can only produce an imagined fiction of humankind? That would be my question for Harari if I met him. I wouldn't start off with that question, but I would want to talk with him. He seems like an interesting human being, very creative. I really enjoy reading his book. And I'm mad at him sometimes too, but I would love to get to know him. But when a claim like this becomes self-defeating like this, it's probably a sign something's going too far, claiming too much, and I think we can be thankful that more is going on in our life than what we're being told. The other day, Josh was telling me how one way to understand heresy in church history is a lack of imagination, in fact. So, for example, either Jesus is God or he's human. Well, we know he was human, so he can't be God. So there's no imagination for how he could be both. So it's about false dilemmas here, really, is either this or that, instead of an imaginative way of saying, how could it be a third way or both? So what if life isn't about an either or, either total modernist objectivity or total postmodern subjectivity? What if it's a mix of both and both are at play? Or what if the history of religion isn't an either-or, either human imagination or God communicating himself? What if it's really a both-and? Both the story of how humans distort and project and sometimes get it right, and how God reveals himself and can overcome our distortions and projections. So why assume because humans can imagine things and imagine even false things that everything they imagine is false? and that God does not exist because of that, or he can't overcome that or deal with that. And we can't work on that together somehow. So if there's a personal creator, and I believe there are good reasons to believe in a personal creator, revelation from him might be something we would expect, would it not? Something to look for, something that could even inform us and correct us. So just even consider the history of science. So people have imagined all kinds of crazy stuff about how the world works. But gradually over centuries, as we've humbled ourselves and been attentive and allowed creation to speak to us in a sense, we've been slowly correcting the ways we've understood the way things work. And if that can happen in science, why can't that happen in other fields outside of science? Even of personal relationships. You first meet somebody and they start talking like somebody else you know, and they look like them, and you're, oh, that person is just like so-and-so. And then you start paying attention, and they reveal themselves to you, and, oh, shoot, no, I was projecting onto them. But over time, that was getting corrected. And so that should be hopeful, that we can do that not just in human relationships, but in our relationship with God. So that God's no blank screen that we just put our projections onto. He answers back. And he's the creator who speaks, who has and is revealing himself in the world, in the scriptures, in his son. In his son, through whom he judges and forgives and overcomes our distortions. So that through the cross, we get the mind, are given the mind of Christ, that knows the Father without distortion or inhibitions whatsoever. And through the Spirit and the Scriptures, we can receive that mind one degree at a time, so that we too can enjoy the sweet knowledge of the Father that Jesus has. So finally, there once was a man named Job who lived in the land of Uz. And he didn't come to this land by a whirlwind. Rather, God came to him in a whirlwind. And Job's three friends, eventually Job himself, they start spewing out all kinds of assumptions about God. Projections, social constructs, imaginations. And God let this go on for a little while. And then he showed up in this vortex of wind with a severe mercy, I think. To rebuke, yes, but also to reveal and restore. And God still comes in the wind of his Spirit, and he speaks to us in Scripture, sometimes in skeptics, and fully and finally through his Son. So may we have ears to hear. Thank you. Thank you. Well, that was a lot. You guys were patient, and that was a lot to take in. I warned you at the beginning it wasn't going to be a walk through the park, but hopefully that was helpful. But now it's time to hear from you. Do you have questions, clarifications, stories? Vance.
So it's, at least for me, like in personal, it's like a, I take that as like a challenge a little bit, that it's like, if I just try to actively live a good Christian life and just read the Bible and do my own thing, I'm going to miss a lot of things. Like, if I'm not having an intellectual faith as well as a spiritual and, you know, faith like in that way. And why do you think that as like a human race over the past few hundred years, we look to these skeptics and people like they've got it all, like they've got it all figured out. Like these are the pinnacle of the human thinkers. And it's like the vast majority of our society is like always pointing these guys out. This is how they know it, and there's no like, I mean, there's like, you know, C.S. Lewis and all like these big guys, but you only know them if you're, you might have heard a couple of things from them, but most of that's just around the Christian circle. But on the whole, as a society, the big thinkers are like people that's going against what God's saying. Why do you think that's so appealing to people? Mm-hmm. And why do you think we as Christians are not worried more about being a bigger vocal voice in the world and having a stance on some of these issues? Not just, you know, because there is people out there, and Christians that are like actively going after these issues.
Yeah.
But on the whole, like out of people my age, like Christians are mostly worried about how they're treating people, I'm trying to work on that, not about trying to be higher thinkers.
Mm.
And so.
Yeah, I mean, I think the scene has changed a lot over the last 60 years, 70 years, but I think people, a lot of, say, these people I've mentioned, well, they've paid attention to something in reality and have seen real true things. And so when somebody is paying attention and saying something significant, they get noticed. And then sometimes, though, people think, well, if they're an expert here, they might be an expert. They're probably an expert everywhere or on anything. And that's not always the case. So a lot of times, yeah, you have like these people who are like some of the new atheists who really know their field of genetics or biology, but in the realm of philosophy or something, they're not as strong, or in history. But people just assume, well, if they're good in one area, they're an expert in another area, and that's not always the case. But yeah, I think Christians should just become good at whatever they do and pay attention. People will listen to you if you have quality stuff. But if you're not paying attention to something outside of the Bible, it's rare for people to take you seriously, I think. I mean, it depends on who you are and what your context is, but I don't know, maybe others have a response to Vance.
Part of the scene, I think, has been a sort of a sublimation of Christian energy into things that are spiritual. And this is intellectual and cold, and we're losing our voice here anyway. And Schaefer got endless static for spending time with these people and their disciples and so on, because why wasn't he spiritual?
Mm.
And I think some of our number in Europe have had a picture of the 19th century when you have a terrific rise of rationalism and attack of, well, the people that you mentioned, Feuerbach and Marx at least, Nietzsche, Freud gets a lot of his ammunition for the 19th century. When these ideas are arising, that was the time when a huge amount of Christian energy from the academic universities went to the mission field. Not that that was bad, but there should have been, what we didn't do is fight the battle at home, where we were really losing the foundation. And to realize that 2 Corinthians 10 talks about it's not a worldly war we're fighting, but a spiritual war, and he goes right into it. I fight for ideas that, you know, and oppose arguments against the existence of God. And so Paul is clear that the spiritual battle must include the battle of ideas,
mm-hmm.
That Paul certainly was fighting. And that it's not more spiritual to go off and not deal with these things, mm-hmm. but that we need to roll up our sleeves and dig in. And of course, things like the Scopes trial have made that worse in this country. Christians have turned their back on engagement with the secular culture altogether. So I think there's been a huge assumption that the spiritual thing, the really Christian thing to do, is to think of prayer, worship, and so on, which of course are absolutely essential and right, but to not tangle with the sort of ideas you're tangling with tonight.
Yeah, so even what it... Yeah.
So we've lost the leadership of the ideas, and now the question is, how do we get back anyway, and if that's what God would allow us to do.
Yeah, I like the Hans Rickmacher would always say, Christ never came to make us Christians, he came to make us human. And this idea of to be a human is to enter all of life, not just some narrow religious sphere. And because typically what we mean by Christian is a narrow, I go to church, I read my Bible. That's the most important. Everything else doesn't matter that much. And but I think the scene has changed. You would say that too, wouldn't you, Dick, since even Schaeffer's time, it's
sure,
been...
in the 20th century, we've tried to get back into it.
Yeah.
And that's with been, resistance, with...
Yeah.
And with a certain amount of success.
Yeah. All right, we got one, two.
I don't have one coherent answer to Nance, but just thoughts. I've been asking similar questions myself lately, and one scripture comes to mind, the kingdom of God is like a lump of yeast that a woman had it, hid in a vat of flour. And there's a sense in which Jesus, this kingdom of God spreads like guerrilla warfare. It doesn't come in with a sword and an army to be noticed. But that's the way I interpret that parable. I may be wrong, but that's the way I interpret it. I'm not trying to say we don't engage, but maybe there's a sense in which the kingdom of God just gets spread on a lower level. The other thought I have is that Jesus said in John 10, if he doesn't do the works of God, don't believe his words. So I come here, but I hate to leave the whole gist of Christianity to be ideas, battles of ideas. If you don't do the works of God, don't believe your words. I mean, Paul said, I came to you in trembling. I didn't want to speak with wise words. I wanted your faith not to be based upon the words of men, but on the power of God. So I take that as a challenge. I don't want to disengage on any level, but I don't want to disengage on that level either. And then Jesus finally said, he said we would know we were his disciples by our love. He didn't say that would make people believe in God, but they at least know we're trying to be like him.
Yeah.
Those are just thoughts. I can't make that all coherent, but they're just ideas that to me surround this issue.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Christianity is incarnational. It's about lived expression of what we're talking about, not just ideas. There's the arena of ideas we need to engage and help ourselves and each other on. But if we just remain in the ideas, we're Platonic. And ideas should be translated into our lives. It looks like lots going on.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, there's a philosopher I quote a lot of times, John McMurray. And is that what you're thinking, Anna? No. No, the philosopher I was going to quote, he said he was trying to actually base his philosophy off of Hebrew thinking and ultimately off the teaching of Jesus, and how he tried to summarize it in two sentences. All meaningful thought is for the sake of action, and all meaningful action is for the sake of friendship. And maybe that's a little too much all, I don't know. Anna thinks it's right on, but but that movement, there should be that, incarnational expression, and friendship is, in the Christian life, one of the ultimate expressions of what we're talking about. And if it's not going on, then something's missing. But Ben, you were going to say something.
That's the whole issue of wish fulfillment and wanting to believe something, and so we construct it in order to fulfill some inner need or whatever. There's a lot of the sort of driving idea behind a lot of these thinkers. I just think that's an interesting issue to really dig into, but in all kinds of areas, both like because you mentioned the it works the other way too. There's all kinds of people, depending on their background and their assumptions and their careers, who really, really, really don't want to believe in God. It's not a comforting idea to them at all. In fact, like you said at the beginning, it's a heroic thing to finally admit that God doesn't exist and walk into the dark. And so there's all kinds of drama and imagination in that, which is a kind of, can function as a kind of wish fulfillment for people who are arguing that God doesn't exist. I just think, though, that we who do believe in God need to be careful of kind of swallowing some of that, I think, because very often in our attitudes towards God, even if we believe he's there, we believe he's real, somehow we think that if some aspect of who he is or what he's said really appeals to me, or if I really, really want something deeply, it must be what God does not want for me. It couldn't be the truth, in other words. And I wonder whether there's some of that suspicion of wish fulfillment has sort of bled into our own concept of God. God couldn't possibly want me to do something with my life that would give me joy. Because that somehow would be me just projecting my desires onto God. Well, maybe not. Maybe God actually does want you to use your gifts and have a fulfilling marriage and all these other things. But somehow, I just wonder, where do you think that comes from, and what we can do to, and it's not as simple as just God just doesn't want me to be happy. But somehow, if I'm suffering, I'm pleasing him. I do think there's something there going on. I don't really know where it comes from.
No, I remember when I was in Bible college, this guy came to me, and he had gone around to a lot of people in the Bible college and asked them, okay, if God wanted you to get married, would he make you marry somebody you didn't like? And almost everybody said yes. He was like, I couldn't believe it. I was like, what in the world? Where do they get this? I mean, I guess that's my question is, where does that come from? And, I mean, surely suffering is part of this life. We're not ever going to get totally out of suffering. But yeah, I guess my question for people is where's your source of information about who God is and what he's like and what he wants? And if it's just your own spontaneous thoughts of the moment, well, you might need something else than that. Or if it's, maybe it's been a tradition in your church to say that kind of thing. Well,
maybe that has to do with your relationship with your father, So this is where
God
comes in.
Well, I'd like to point out this book by Paul Vitz. Have you read this one, Faith of the Fatherless? Has anyone read this one? Dick, yeah. So basically he took Freud's insights and about how what happens in our childhood really does play out in how we think of God. And so he tried to find as many famous Christians and theists as he could, and as many famous atheists throughout history as he could. And what were their fathers like? And what weren't they like? And there was a huge pattern. Again, you don't want to make this another nothing but kind of thing, but by far, you could probably guess that the majority of atheists had absent fathers, fathers that had died, or very defective, or maybe even outright abusive fathers. And most of the Christians had great fathers, or pretty decent fathers. It wasn't a deterministic thing, obviously, but I think it's also there to say, hey, if someone's struggling in trying to believe in God and that God is good, maybe if I had their father, I'd be in a worse place. Or, it should cause us to have some humility, not to think we can just figure them out and explain all their belief or unbelief in that way, but to approach people with a little more compassion and humility. And, if I had a different upbringing, my faith might look a little different. And so let's be patient. And I think even with that, I use the word father a lot here, but I don't think that should be a name we should push on people to call God right away, especially if they've had a really tough, difficult time with their father. There's other images and names for God you can start with and work with, and maybe down the road they'll be in a better place to know what Jesus meant by that word.
My answer to Ben about where that idea come from, one definition of religion is to bind oneself to please deity. And by that definition, Christianity is not a religion. By that definition, you know, the Indian mystic, you know, lays on a bed of nails, stares at the sun, crawls all the way to some lake and walks around it 7 times. You do difficult things to please deity. And I don't think as believers we quite get it that Jesus did the difficult thing to bring us to God. And we just don't, my personal belief is that we don't quite get it. We are religious spirited beings. We think we need to do something to please God or something difficult or some sort of a sacrifice. That would be my answer. It's very hard to get past that. To really grasp the grace of God. But by that definition, I mean, you've heard people say religion's not a, you know, Christianity's not a religion, because it's not man seeking God. It's God having sought man.
Yeah, I mean, that is, if you do study the history of religion and the ultimate movements of different religions, yeah, there is generally the movement of religions are from us to God. The major movement. And then in Christianity, the major movement is God to us. That is pretty different than anything else. It's not that there's not something of our movement to God in Christianity, but it's not the major theme.
Well, speaking for myself, I make that the major theme. I have to keep repenting of it.
Yes, exactly. No, it's... Yeah, we've got false constructs that need to be corrected. And I think that is part of the history of religion, if you look at it. A couple of people we haven't heard from, one, two, and then Vance.
Okay. Just real briefly, I read something recently, I forgot exactly where it was, where the person said that it took him 50 years to erase the image of his father from the image of God. And I think that somehow speaks to what you were saying about it's not either or. You know, it's not either that God's there, you know, the God who is there, right? And it has nothing to do with our fathers, or it's all about our fathers.
Yeah.
I thought that was fascinating. 50 years, and, you know, he had a horrible experience with his dad, and I've forgotten all the details, but it took him 50 years to erase the picture of his dad from the picture. I thought that was really pretty profound. I liked that.
Wow. That's persevering too. No, that fits. Yeah, it shows though how patient we need to be with ourselves and each other and make room for something like that. Yeah. Because sometimes we're so impatient and, you know, come on, get on with it. And it's unkind, but Anna, did you have?
Was it me?
You in advance, I think. Did you? Maybe next. Okay.
Well, this is maybe a really different direction, so I don't know if Vance wants to stay in the same direction or something, but. Okay, I'll just throw it out there anyway. We've been talking about this a lot lately, so it's not fair to put you on the spot, but you brought in some new ideas along these lines when you were talking about The Wizard of Oz. And this message that they got, which was essentially, everything that you need is already inside of you. And I feel like, without naming particular authors, I've been reading lately a lot of Christian authors who are saying something really similar now, who are writing currently, you know, who are essentially saying this idea of, you know, Christ in all, and that repentance or conversion is mostly like recognizing the Christ that's already in you. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't know, do you have some kind of new thoughts along those lines, given what you said about The Wizard of Oz? I don't know your thoughts along those lines, but, or maybe other people, maybe
I'll get to hear them now.
Or maybe other people too have thoughts there. I just think that's not just like some kind of secular story. I feel like I'm hearing a little nuance, but that story is alive and well, even in some versions of Christianity. Mm-hmm. Say that say conversion is like recognizing you already have everything you need, almost, as opposed to like you need to be, you need to die and be buried and be raised again with Jesus, which is a very different story.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I mean, because it's not super flattering to hear that you need to die and be raised, but it's not about humiliating you. It's about how much God loves you. He wants you a new self. It's not like he doesn't care about you. That's why he wants to crucify you, but he wants your new self so much. And so I think that's, and sometimes though we it can be presented in a way that's really demeaning to people. I think in our, in wanting to be politically correct maybe, and everybody's the same, we want to just say the same thing about everybody, and but not everybody's at the same place in their journey with God. And the scriptures surely have, well, Ben, you got some.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't know what to do, but it seems to me, it just seems like sort of a secular cliche that's just making its way into so much, and as we've been hearing it for ages. Like every Disney movie basically has that theme, that your strength was in you all along. You know, you just needed to find your inner strength. It's who, you know, dig deep. And you, I was listening to the radio today. I haven't seen the Wrinkle in Time movie, but my kids and my wife just read the book recently, and the interviewer on NPR was talking about how why is it that the movie is really sort of embracing a secular form of empowerment as opposed to the book, which is really talking about spiritual power. And so anyway, interesting discussion. But at the end of this segment, they played some music from the soundtrack of Wrinkle in Time, and it's the song that I Believe. And it's all about, I believe in me. I believe in me. I can do anything as long as I believe in me. And that's like, it's just the biggest cliche I've ever heard. It's like, oh, really? Like, again?
And Madeline Langle is...
It's like rolling over in her grave.
So I just
think it's like part of self-esteem culture, maybe, that how, you know, it's really maybe psychologically damaging to us to actually believe that I really need to be changed, that I've there's something really wrong in me. But it's much more esteem building to be told that no, you already have it. It's just about your perception of yourself, you know. Just perceive yourself differently, and then you'll do anything you want. It's just like there's so much evidence to the contrary of that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, and I think, sorry. I mean, there's a long history behind this too. Charles Taylor, I brought him in, Bob. See, he always gets into my lectures at some point. But he said he shows how there's this movement to the secular world, the secular age we live in, where we understood ourselves as these porous beings. So beings that would be receiving and giving things, our identity was even porous. And it moved to a buffered self, he called it, where our identity is totally self-enclosed and within myself. And so I don't receive anything that I need for who I am. And this is a new modern thing. This isn't something you can trace back to the pre-modern times. It's a very modern thing. And so I think that's where all this plays out too. Well, then within that narrative, what you need has to be within yourself, because that's who you are. You're totally self-contained. And then that can just get translated into Christian terms. Yeah. And yeah, surely, I mean, the Christian understanding of even conversion, there are moments, the moment of like receiving God. I think Martin Buber, you brought him in there, Jeff. We had a lot of talks with Martin Buber. And, he was asked, where does God live one time? And he said, God lives where he's let in. And I think that there's something true to that he's not a force. He doesn't enter you by force. He enters you by faith, because he's not one to force his way into the core of your being. He wants to be welcomed as he welcomes you. And that needs to be understood. And even though it's not like, I think you need to see your life as a continual receiving from God. And so it's not like, oh yeah, I received God at a moment of conversion and then I'm good to go. But there's this constant, like John says at the beginning, I received grace upon grace. And my every day, I'm trying to be open to receive from God and even from others. And so I'm trying to imagine myself more porous. I think that's more true to the nature of who we really are. I mean, you know, it just shows, you know, you say like you're in a great mood and somebody's in a funk and they come into the room and suddenly their funk is on you. How did that happen? I was in a good mood and you just gave me your funk. And, you know, it just shows how porous we are. And we're not so self-contained. I mean, even Freud's whole thing with what happens in childhood. Anyways, I could go on and on, but yeah. There's way more, I think, you could say on that, but... Mary Frances.
Yeah, I, what you said about the being porous, and it's helpful, because I was going to say, I feel like it's a little bit of, like, a both and a, because I think, on the one hand, there can be this idea that when we become Christians or we let Christ in, then everything about us has to be decimated. You know, that everything has to die. And I think there are ways where it's like, no, we don't have to lose our sense of humor or particular giftedness. Or I think there's ways that God uses that differently, but our whole personality and self isn't eradicated because he made us a certain way to begin with. But yet there is this sense of a dying to self and a dying of sort of the ego and the pride. And I think that I think it's interesting, like, the Christ within me or the Christ within you. I mean, I think there's also a sense of, like, are we talking about two Christians? Or are we talking about someone who's not a Christian? Like, how is that being framed? Because, I mean, I can speak for myself. I don't think I am as aware as I should be of the power of Christ that does reside in me. That Christ, I mean, that's not, I'm embarrassed to say, that's not the place that I operate out of most of the time. It's like the Holy Spirit is here. Christ is within me. And there's, my pastor did a sermon recently, he's going through the Beatitudes. He started on the Mount talking about meekness. What is meekness? And he's saying, it's like, meekness is not weakness. Meekness is you don't have a need to exert your own power because you rest in the power of Christ that is within you. That it's not about you and your own power. It's your, you can take a step back because the power of Christ is there. So I don't know. I do feel like it's a little bit of, you know, but being a Christian doesn't mean that we're completely stripped of how God made us to begin with and who we are. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah, and even like to even just go back to the image of God and say, well, that everybody represents and reflects God, even in their brokenness, even if they're not a Christian. There's something true of that. And to maybe just start there, you know, how is this person already, even now, still representing and reflecting God? And how, I mean, each of us do that in a unique way. And so, yeah, you have this prohibition in the Old Testament to against idols and making a physical thing of God, because you don't need that, because they're everywhere. We have these representations all around us, and we need to be paying attention to that. And I think also imagining, hey, if this person, what would this person be like, too, if they allowed God in their life and he was to start restoring them? What would that start to look like, and how can I have hope for that and treat them along those lines, too, like thinking of them not just in the present, but what they also could be? So to see people in a bigger picture. But wait, here, because we had a long time ago in advance.
Yeah. I got to see if I can get my mind back to where I was when I was talking before. But I think humility plays a large part in this. When, like, when you were talking about how we can set up our own theology as an idol, when we talk, we have to know our limitations. And there's a real balance we have to have between really sticking to our guns when we truly believe something, but having the humility and the openness to be teachable at all times. Mm. Maybe not to be contradicted by what we believe, but to even learn about, understand it more deeply than we do, or to see different spins on it. Or at times to find out, hey, I was wrong.
Yeah. You know?
And to admit that and be willing to change. And I think you see all this idolatry through all the people you talked about. You know, I've got my psychological view, I've got my genetic view, I've got my, you know, and we try, and we don't know our own limitations, and, you know, and it's so much bigger than that, as you were saying.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, you have to, humility is a very big part of coming to grips with this stuff, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And integration with different fields of knowledge and perspectives, that's the bigger need, I think, because, I mean, now, especially when disciplines are getting so specialized, and, you know, you don't have time, if you're specialized in one thing, to think of another one, and then to think of how they relate to each other. But that's a huge gap. That's what I've been told in the university settings. It used to be called a university for a reason, but that's not an appropriate name anymore. A lot of the disciplines don't come together and aren't integrated. And that's a huge need because you also need humility to say, hey, my field of knowledge is limited, even if it's specialized. Mm-hmm. But
knowing your limits.
Yeah. Exactly. I agree. Thanks.
So, like, as a person, like, actively trying to live all this out, and you're, like, not trying to be too much on this side, and you're trying to live a balance and a good life, and you're like, okay, I'm going to try to get a lot of knowledge about these ideas, and I'm going to try to do these things, whatever. And then it's like, and you're competing against, the same person my age, he's got thoughts against why God, and I've got thoughts with God. And it's like, I'm going on my path, going harder, and I'm like, man, this is miserable. Like, I need to go do something, some off time, and you sit there and try to live a balanced life. And it's like, do I really even want to just be pursuing this? Do I just want to live simply, almost? And then the other person, they're just steady on trotting. They don't care about living a good life, necessarily. They're just all about this issue that they have, or like all about this one thing. But then as a Christian, you're trying to live balanced and have time for prayer and have time for loving people and have time for family and have time for these different aspects and trying to live a balanced, good, happy life. But the person that's on the secular side that's fighting your ideas, they're just living like a miserable life, but they're still just like beating you on your issue. Because you're sitting there trying to live a good life, and it's at some point, I mean, and I feel like that's maybe one reason why they have gotten the upper hand a little bit, is because they've been so dedicated and motivated. And, like, I mean, yeah, like, I could see myself sitting there diving in on some of these issues, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, like, okay, I'm about to put myself in a couple $100,000 of debt in Christian education. And then this other guy, he's going to come off debt-free from his secular education. And I'm sitting here trying to struggle all this and balance all these issues and trying to live a good life. And then the ways of society is setting him up more to succeed in those ideas. So there's more of like trying to win. It's hard because even as a Christian, you're thinking, oh, I'm not really trying to win.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to live a good life. And for this other person, it flares as well. Mm-hmm. And then the other person, he's just like, I'm trying to win. Ultimately.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in some ways, I think you're voicing, it's harder to be a Christian. There are things that make it more difficult. You have other concerns sometimes that other people don't have. Other things you feel like you should be paying attention to. But it can also be more rewarding and more exhilarating too. If you're doing the things you're supposed to be doing, we can sometimes put false burdens on ourselves and make ourselves think like, yeah, I need to be the next Christian apologist who tackles all these ideas and has the right answer for everything. If that's not what we're supposed to do, that's going to be a miserable life and we might make a mess of things. So I think it's important. I mean, my way is, Jesus, what do you have for me? what am I supposed to be doing? I don't want to do more than that, and I don't want to do less than that. Kind of like the end of Proverbs a bit, you know, don't give me too many riches that I don't need you, and too little that I start stealing. But and I think that kind of prayer is important, both as your life as a whole, but also daily. Because, you can go berserk with all the things you're supposed to do, and that's not necessarily what God is intending. The thing is, we're not supposed to be, it's not about winning, but it's being faithful. And that does look different for different people. And, if I gave the impression, to be a good Christian means you got to figure all these guys out and have an answer for everything. I didn't mean that, and that maybe that came off, but it was just meant to be a way to think about. And when you approach people who are hostile to you, they're like, just slow down and go, okay, wait, they're coming at me, but what might I be able to learn here, and what how can I go forward?
Genesis before he had this encounter with Christ. And I think when we talk about C.S. Lewis, that I hear a lot about his life after he started following Jesus. But he was already an Oxford professor in his, so I'm wondering, in your reading and sort of the lay of the landscape, are there people who are already in positions of high influence within these fields who are coming to follow Christ? Like the idea of when Dick was here and saying, like, we abandoned the home front when we were sending people out to the least reached, but maybe ignoring the home front of sort of in the academies and in these places of influence. Do you hear about people who are already in positions of, like, influence within, like, the bioethics community or the geneticists, who are having encounters with Christ and coming to, like, follow him, already being in a place of influence?
Yes, I do. I hear those stories, but a lot of times they're not trying to show off or, like, hey, look what I'm doing. So, because as a Christian, that's not how you're supposed to do it.
Right.
And I think there can be a way of being too self-conscious, like, how do we look to the world, and how do I look more like Jesus, instead of just focusing on being like Jesus, or whatever place you're in. And so, I hear a lot of Christians doing a lot of great work in all kinds of places, in all kinds of fields, but they're not tooting their horn, so you don't always hear about them. But typically, I think, the people who have a lot to say, especially in the Christian life, have been people who have done something in the world really well. I mean, C.S. Lewis, he knew literature, he knew stories, and he wasn't even trained as a theologian, really, and look what he wrote. I mean, powerful stuff. And I think we need to think along those lines more, just not so that we can be an impressive people, in a sense. That can be too self-conscious, but just to be faithful, and because these are worthwhile things to do, and people are worth it, and people are worth loving, and God's world is worth knowing about. And
I guess the reason I was asking the question is because we hear stories coming out of, like, the Muslim world about Muslims having encounters with Christ and coming to follow him, and sometimes staying kind of secret and quiet about that. But
yeah,
Jesus is on the move all over the world. Is he not still on the move, like, within the academy? Is maybe kind of what I'm wondering.
It seems like what, at least I've heard, and sometimes I've heard of more movements in some disciplines as opposed to others.
Okay.
So, like, in physics, I don't know if it's just because they're more open or what, but people who are claiming to be Christians and who are physicists, just because they're dealing with some wacky stuff, and I think it's mysterious, so they're open to there being a being who could create all this crazy stuff. Where other disciplines are like, I don't know what it is, but and even philosophy, I think there's way more Christians, who are philosophers, who are taken seriously for their stuff, just as philosophers. And there's been a turn there. It wasn't the case. There was few and far Christians. There were far and few between. But
in biology, for example, the whole intelligent design folks, it'd be interesting to know some of their biographies and how many of them sort of had credentials or had a reputation in biology before they came to intelligent design.
Yeah.
I've forgotten the last name of the man who is head of NIH, who is a strong Christian. I'm blocking on his last name. But I've heard him speak, and he's just doing his job as a scientist.
Yeah.
Collins, is that?
Francis Collins, is that what you think? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. He wrote The Language of God, is that the book? Yeah. Yeah.
Crick. No?
What's that?
Is it Francis Crick?
That was
he discovered DNA.
Yeah, that was, he wasn't writing that kind of a book. He was writing something else, but he was more deterministic. But but he was a geneticist.
Not really. Well, maybe a question. Just reflecting back to one of the Ant's questions, and even this idea of secularism creeping into our own theologies and a lot of the Christian living books that are out. Not just Christian living, it's broader than that. I do wonder if where a lot of churches are now, especially having grown up in the South, there's this cultural aspect of Christianity that has really tainted and distorted our understanding of how to receive and be open to correction and open to refinement in what does having a theological lens look like, a right lens look like. And so I wonder if even as within a family unit, starting there and within our churches, within other social contexts, how do we introduce this idea of questioning and holding our theologies lightly, loosely, so that we are open to receiving from the people around us who are asking really wonderful questions that, having grown up in a Christian home, I went to a secular university and probably had some of the best Bible studies I had in my entire life because for the first time I was questioning and delving into hard aspects of what does it mean to be human and what does it mean to live in this world in light of being made in the image of God. So I wonder just thinking in that context, why are there not more people in the academy who are speaking truth and who are delving into some of these really challenging issues and are conversing? And then I think of Tim Keller having a conversation and being able to explain an atheistic argument better than the person that he's on stage with. There are people who have been thoughtful in their formation, and how do we begin to spread that influence to other generations, because I do think that there's a lot of things that the church has done a disservice to the current and upcoming generations for.
Yeah. That's a big question. Yeah.
Like,
how do we reform the church? Yeah. That's the thing. We always need reformation too. Like, because I think the Protestant tradition can think of the Reformation as if it all got figured out then. Not that we constantly need reformation. We constantly need to be challenged and changed, and even just like basic things like what does faith mean? Is faith absolute certainty? I think that's a lot of what Christians think faith means, and therefore you have doubt. Oh no, I'm sinning. I don't have faith because I have had some doubts or some questions. And it's like, that just means to be human. I mean, anything you believe, things come against it and call it into question, and you have to wrestle with things. Nothing is so clear-cut that you never have a doubt. You never have a question about it, and that's unfortunate. It feels like that comes out of more an Enlightenment, modernist idea of knowledge, that we can have this absolute objectivity without where the subject somehow disappears and doubts disappear. And that, and then we read certain passages in the Old Testament with that understanding, and then see, it's in the Bible, but you've read that passage with a certain interpretation for a long time, and you need to question that sometimes. And that's why we do need to pay attention to the time we live in and what are the influences upon the church. Because when people are like, it's just me and my Bible, I'm like, well, it's probably more than just you and your Bible. You're probably most in danger of something else than the Bible because you don't pay attention. You're not thinking about that.
Or they don't even know how to think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that's a large portion of it as well. It's the heap. I think there's, again, good things, prayer, scripture, fellowship, wonderful. But that is not all that formation in the image of God, in the image, ever more after the image of Christ looks like. And so how do you equip people to know how to read scripture rightly or how to,
Yeah, those are all questions. Valid ones. Next.
This is on a, it's going back to a comment that John over there made earlier, so it's kind of a bit different from what we were just talking about. But you talked about humility, and I think that, you know, with a lot of these thinkers are seeing extremes, and I think you mentioned that as well. So you have, you know, humanists who believe that, you know, man is great, and you have atheists who believe that man is worthless and wretched, but in his passe, Pascal says that Christianity kind of strikes the balance because it teaches that man is both great, that we've been created in the image of God, but we're also wretched, of course, because of our sin, because we ultimately, you know, in Christ we killed God, in effect. And so it's not about these extremes, but it's about a balance. It's about the both and that Christianity kind of presents to us.
Yeah. Yeah, Schaefer had the phrase, we're magnificent ruins. And that kind of, he's trying to bring together that both and, like you're saying. And that's hard. Yeah, it's easier always to pick one thing. Like, we're just great people all the time, deep down. We never do anything wrong. And then, or we're just a big ball of sin. And that's, it's easier conceptually to do one or the other, but to start to integrate things, that's the, like, that's the harder thing. That's life, though.
Something I've been grappling with is this idea of, like, how do we come from, like, an insignificant ape to a human?
Mm-hmm.
You said there the main argument is imagination.
Yeah.
Well, I'm kind of wondering, how do they justify, like, where that imagination comes from? Because I think a lot of, like, the survival of the fittest, and if it's really like a dog-eat-dog type world that we live in, why do we need art? Why do we need community? Why do we need film and culture and other things? And I was wondering if that's kind of an argument that's been used in terms of refuting some of these things. Or
yeah, well, when Harari talks about it, about where did it come from and how did it happen, he's like, we have no idea. Somehow, at some point, it showed up on the scene, randomly, by accident, but with the benefit of giving us the ability to create myths and then to dominate the planet. So he has no explanation. And so, yeah, I mean, for me, that's... like, Harari himself, he's a super creative guy. He's really funny, insightful, enjoyable guy. To me, he points me to a creator. Because like, yeah. Like, where does that creativity come from?
Yeah.
I mean, you've got two choices. Ultimately, whether through evolution or not, to me it doesn't matter, but ultimately it's either an impersonal something or a creative source. And so to me, it makes more sense to me that everything, a creative being like Harari, comes from an ultimate creative source. That doesn't seem like craziness to me. It seems to make sense. And that's, I think, what other people would say who would affirm or want to propose that there is a creator and that makes sense. Is it's the best account of everything put together. But I think in even doing that, it's always good to say there's things, there's because ofs and then spite ofs. This is Greg Lowry's.
Oh, yeah.
He used to direct the former Swiss, he was the former director of Swiss Debris. He had all these cool little sayings. But one of them was, whatever you believe, you're going to have because ofs and in spite ofs. Whether you're believing a scientific theory or in the character of your friend or in God. And there's going to be things in life that support that, confirm that, and then there's going to be things that come against it. There's going to be voices. There's going to be disasters or whatever. And it's going to seem to contradict that. So that's where the doubts come in. But it's good to be honest with that. And I think the scriptures even have examples of that where it's like, hey, this is how it looks. It doesn't look good, God, in relation to what you promised and what's happening. And that's not something we have to be afraid of, and God's not afraid of, but that's part of faith, and of any faith in anything, but especially with God. So, I would want to point to a lot of things that to me are pointers to God, but then there's things in life that don't seem to point to a good creator, and I have to be honest with that. And we should. I don't think we need to hide that. I don't think that's being unfaithful or something. It's just being honest. Oh, wait, in the back, and then Ben.
Yeah, just on the subject of creativity in The Everlasting Man, there's a chapter where G.K. Chesterton talks about this very issue. And he talks about the art that's found on the walls of these caves thousands of years ago, and how human creativity isn't a matter of distinction along a continuum, but it's a mark of absolute difference, that it's something that is characteristic of humanity, that is this like hallmark, that is absolutely reflective of God in this significant and distinctive way. So it's not a matter of degree, but it's a matter of absolute distinction. Mm-hmm. That's just powerful testimony that is tragically missed out on in his conceptualization.
Yeah. Yeah. And Christians need to use their creativity a little more sometimes. If we're made in the image of the Creator, yeah, that sure would make sense and fit. But we should be more in tune with that and more expressive of that. But Ben, and then I think I saw a hand over here.
Yeah, just a quick answer to your question, Jonathan. Just one, in terms of what are arguments made to explain things we see all around us about people that don't seem to serve any immediate, like, advantage. They seem gratuitous, right? Like, people making art. Like, what is the... just one example of the kind of reductionism that you've been talking about, Dave, is I think particularly combined evolutionary biology and neuroscience together. I think those two things together, I think, can claim to explain almost anything. I mean,
yeah.
Not rightly, but the claim seems to be even more ironclad, that everything can be explained between the interaction between those two disciplines. And so, you know, anything that we see in human society today that we can't immediately explain, well, it became through millions of years of evolution hardwired into our neurocircuitry in our brains to serve a purpose millions of years ago. That purpose may no longer exist anymore, or the need for that may no longer exist anymore, but what we see is the residual, I mean, our brains are still hardwired that way, and it's all a residual, we just happen to still be acting that way, even though society has moved past the point of needing this. And so, but if you claim that, I mean, it's almost like you can basically, if you try hard enough, explain anything you want that way, without necessarily having any evidence to say that that's what's actually happening. You know, it's but I think those two disciplines, when combined together, have huge power in our culture today. Like, if someone can use evolutionary biology and neuroscience together to make a claim, it's just like,
oh yeah,
drop the mic and walk away.
Yeah, that's it. There's nothing else to say.
Yeah.
Isn't that the science of the gap? That if there's a gap, there must be a scientific explanation mm-hmm. for it, just like people have the God of the gap, you know, we'll just throw God in there.
I mean, but it's good to say, yeah, there is a scientific way to look at everything, but there's a poetic way to look at everything, you know, and then there's a theological way to look at everything. It's good to say, like, there are different ways, but each way is limited. It's not saying everything there is to say about that particular thing. And to make room for other voices. other fields of knowledge is so important. And yeah, like Harari, he doesn't have a lot of room for poetry. I mean, he pretty, you know, it's cute. It's, it's like, oh, come on, man. But anyways.
Sometimes you talk about science as a source of authority. And I heard a top scientist at MIT say it is less a source of authority than a successful mode of inquiry. Because at any point in time, the cutting-edge science is wrong. I mean, there are hypotheses and candidate solutions, and I don't know what's going on. So it's less a source of authority than a successful mode of inquiry. And so I think that helps put it, even when we're having a good Bible study in a Christian university, I try to think, what is a successful mode of inquiry? You know, not, you know, in the realm,
yeah,
in the realm of trying to know God. So I'm not trying to say, let's bring science in, but I'm trying to just have that, just ask that question. What is a successful mode of inquiry? How can I get somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think people doing real science aren't the ones promoting scientism.
Yeah.
Scientism comes from philosophers or historians who don't know much about, who aren't doing science. The scientists are busy getting to work. They're being humble. They're focusing. They're paying attention, and they're discovering things. But many times they're just saying, "Hey, this is what I've seen. I know there's other stuff going on, but this is what I know." And it's the other people who are speaking into that who you're gonna.
Yeah, I was gonna pick up on this business about authority. We talked about the modern age, postmodern age, and actually the ancient age. And one way I've thought of it is the ancient age, knowledge, all knowledge came from authority. Not only from God, but actually from the Pope and Aristotle and the King. So you learn things by received from on high,
mm-hmm,
or from authority, whoever above you. The modern age was Galileo and others saying, wait a minute, the truth comes from the objective world. We can do experiments, and anybody can do those experiments, record them, and then repeat it. The postmodern age I wrestle with, I think the source of authority comes from within me. In the postmodern age, it's my subjective truth. And I'm just mentioning that because that, I think that parallels your thrust of the evolution of the whole idea of tonight.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. There's a good, important, long story, I think, that goes along with that. Yeah, the Copernican Revolution was huge and eventually led to, we're in a meaningless universe and we're meaning makers. We make meaning in a meaningless universe. That's kind of an assumption of many people. Even a lot of Christians, I think, talk about the world as empty and meaningless, apart from God, and it's more a product of the times, I think, than actually...
The direction here, where do we get truth? You know, we used to think it came with all... I don't think it's all of everyone. We still do, today, some of us still believe in the real truth.
The divine right of kings has been flipped upside down. Yeah, it's no longer the way, but...
We started with all truth coming from outside us, and now in the extreme, all truth comes from within inside us, the non-forest being.
Yes. Yep. And that's
just, I think I'm agreeing with you that maybe we shouldn't be so quick to pick one as the whole way.
Yes, exactly. That would be one of the points I'm trying to say tonight. Thank you. I did communicate something, I guess, somewhat clearly. I'm seeing the time though here, it's just after 10, so I'd like to wrap it up. But thank you, everybody. Thanks for the discussion.